back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are completely calm, and we're staying local as it gets around here. I got to give a shout-out, first things first, to our great sponsor, Taharka. Made in Baltimore, the delicious awakening more than just your taste buds. I got pistachio here, and the only reason I'm holding this is because I ate it all, and I can now have the empty canister. Your Don Moeller has a freezer full of Taharka ice cream. We appreciate their sponsorship. We'll be telling their story all summer long here as we enjoy things like the Honey Graham and the Wake and Bake. Shout out to Fadley's downtown. We probably would have had our guest today, Don, at Fadley's for a crab cake in other circumstances before COVID. I know we've been trying to get Duray McKesson on for a period of time. This is going to be a great, great visit. But next time, I promise, it'll either be Fadley's or the homeland of yours in Catonsville over there at State Fair. And I know they're opening a Mexican restaurant across Frederick Road as well, right, Don?
Absolutely. Can't wait. Should be open in a couple of months.
And, of course, Moeller and Gary Realty. And I'll let our guests talk about your son, Jeff Moeller, and the fantastic Moeller and Gary group and selling homes here in COVID. Still closing deals, still listing homes. Don, this is a special interview for you because certainly Baltimore and all of the unrest and the protest and all of this stuff, this person is not unknown to our audience here, but I know you know him better. I only know him from television.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, Duray McKesson, and his partner in Campaign Zero, Sam Sinyangwe. Duray is a proud graduate of Catonsville High School, and we're proud of all of our comments, and he worked closely with Coach Mike Moeller over there on the girls' basketball program and has truly gone on to bigger and greater things. Duray, thanks for joining us. Sam, thanks for joining us, guys, on Baltimore Positive.
It's good to be here.
Duray, let's just jump right into it. We are, for the past several weeks, we're just reliving a nightmare that continues to happen in the United States of America. It seems that just weeks ago we watched a young African-American man, Aubrey Ahmad, being murdered while jogging through a neighborhood by a group of folks in a pickup truck. We then see a police officer murder George Floyd on the streets of Minneapolis, basically asphyxiating him with a knee to the neck. We're now in the middle of national unrest that we have not seen since the 1960s. Certainly a lot of your activism came out of Ferguson, Missouri. I wonder if you'd just give us sort of your perspective and give our audience a sense of when you saw it happened again, and when you watched that video of George Floyd again, what went through your mind?
Yeah, you know, it has been a long 6 years since the protests began originally in 2014 in St. Louis, and to zoom out a little bit, I just got to remind you that the police have actually killed more people since the protests, not less. A third of all the people killed by a stranger in the United States is actually killed by a police officer. In 2019 was actually the first year ever where black people were more afraid of being killed by an officer than being killed by community violence. So these issues have just, like, they stay consistent across time and place. We even think about March and April of 2020. The police killed as many people as they did in March and April of 2019. So COVID, quarantine, lockdown actually didn't change the numbers at all. So when we look at Minneapolis, it is not shocking in the sense that we knew something like this would happen because the data has shown this. But when we look at Minneapolis, we also are realizing that in Minneapolis, black people are 13 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than a white person. It's the highest racial disparity with regard to police violence in the country. So the numbers are not good. And what we've not seen is courage from our political leaders to put policies, practices, and solutions in place to make the numbers go down.
Duray, this thing's come full circle for you. I mean, you talk about your background in Catonsville and Jeff and Don, and before Don was the county executive. You were in Minneapolis, right? I mean, you were there and wound up in St. Louis. Is that correct? I mean, I'm just trying to put all this together. The what in 14, your life changed dramatically. From Ferguson and all the things on Twitter and your background. Run me through your mind that summer and where you were then and where you are Baltimore now that it is escalated to this point where I live in downtown Baltimore, and you know, a lot of folks that I know you're aware of walk past my house every day here this week. I remember when they were canceling baseball games here 5 years ago. We all want, well, not maybe all, certainly everybody in my audience wants to make this thing better. What was it for you in 14 that really moved you from teaching to doing this?
Yeah, so I used to lead staffing for the school system in Minneapolis. I worked in the central office. I was responsible for hiring all employees in the district, all levels. And that was a great job, and it was a weekend. And I used to teach sixth grade math 12 years ago in East New York, Brooklyn, and New York City. And then I moved back home to Baltimore, and then I moved to Minneapolis. And I was in Minneapolis when my brown got killed, and I was trying to figure out what happened. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to go for the weekend and just, like, be a support. And then I got tear gas the first time, and I was like, I'll do whatever I can to make sure that nobody has to experience this. And I stayed. You know, we were in the street for 400 days, and that was it was dramatic and long and intense. And as you know, those protests changed the way the country talked about race and justice, which is a big one. And here we are in 2020, sort of reliving so much of that, but also people fed up and tired in a different way. Who realize that the solutions haven't been in place. And you know, you live in Baltimore. You know, I live in Mount Vernon. I live by the bun shop in Mount Vernon. You live downtown. And you know, like I know, there was a whole division of the police department that got indicted, the GTPF, and nothing happened. No systemic changes, no plan to, like, redo the police department. No, like, so in Baltimore, we actually haven't seen any aggressive changes outside of the consent decree, even though a whole division of the police department got indicted. That's wild.
Well, DeRay, go back to the beginning of Black Lives Matter. Talk to us about how, and to our audience who's familiar, you know, they've heard the term, that they know the group. Talk to us about how the group actually evolved and how it grew to the size that it is today.
Yes, it's important to think about how we all just watched the protest start in Minneapolis and then organically spread across the country. That's what happened in 2014. That there was no 1, 2, 3, 4 people who spread the protest across the country. The protest just spread, and it was beautiful. So when we think about growing, the movement grows quickly because all over the country these issues are present. And I think we see that. So when people say Black Lives Matter, it's an umbrella to define a moment that is happening right now. It's a statement that is both true and a rallying cry. And that's what you see happening. So it's beautiful that, you know, I think the other day there were protests in all 50 states for the first time, and that was incredible happening. But it grew because the inequity is there in every city. It grew because the police are killing people in communities all across the country. You know, what's interesting, because, you know, Mueller, you were the Baltimore County executive, is that what we find is that police violence is actually decreasing in cities but increasing in rural and suburban communities at a rate that is so great that it's actually wiping out the gains that we get in cities. So there's a lot of work to be done, especially in suburban communities and rural communities.
DeRay, I want to bring your partner in, Samuel Sinyamwe. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing that right, from Campaign Zero. Take me back 5 or 6 years, Sam, and talk about the beginning of this. And I always tell Don I'm going to write a book called First Look, the first time people have ever met, and then had a bond that's formed. Certainly for you in the beginning of this, Stanford University and Stay Woke and Campaign Zero, you finding DeRay and more like-minded people finding each other, because this isn't a fight of that one person or any one organization or one city. This is clearly a global effort at this point, right?
That is true. And so just to take us back to late 2014, DeRay on the ground in Ferguson, I reached out online. I really reached out through Twitter, saying that I can get involved, I can help build a data system, a database system across the country. I gave me his phone number, and I called him that day, and we talked about the database. For some reason, he believed in me. And so we started building together. We built a range of different platforms together with PacNet and folks really all across the country who helped out and volunteered and created
for Sam.
Yeah, Sam, we're breaking up, pal. DeRay, pick that up for me and pick up where he was going with this about the database, because we're really having some contact problems with Sam.
Sam, your sound's messing up. So the database is that we manage the most comprehensive database of police violence in the country. So we manage a database that's all on-duty killings, off-duty killing, with all weapons. And that matters because the other database that you know is the Washington Post, and we like the Post. But the Post database only includes on-duty killings that include a gun. So Eric Garner, who was killed in New York, he's not in the Post database. Mr. Floyd, who was killed in Minneapolis, he's not in the database. And then Botham Jean, who you remember, the officer walked into his apartment in the middle of the night and killed him, thinking it was her apartment, she said. He's not in the database because she was off-duty. So Sam actually built that for us, and he manages it every day. So it's the most comprehensive database of police violence in the country. Our data has been used in over 1,300 studies in the past couple of years, and I'm really proud of that. But we tried to have a data-focused approach to how we end police violence and how we rethink public safety in a way that doesn't center police.
Well, DeRay, walk us through then, fast forward us, because what's gotten certainly a lot of discussion the past few days, and I hope something that has some legs. I see that Senator Schumer has asked that Senator Booker and Senator Harris work together on coming up with a real police reform legislation nationwide. I am assuming that the proposals in the 8 Can't Wait will be part of that. I wonder if you can give us a sense of what 8 Can't Wait, what the proposals are, because when I read through them, they seemed common sense to me, and I'm thinking, why aren't we doing this? So can you walk our audience through what 8 Can't Wait is?
Yeah. Sam, is your audio back? Are you in a better place?
I hope so. Let me know.
There you are. Let's talk to us, Sam.
All right. Brilliant. Yeah, so 8 Can't Wait is a set of 8 policy restrictions. What we looked at was the 100 largest cities in the country. We looked at their use of force policies. These are the policies that determine how and in what context officers can use force, how much force they can use in particular situations. And so we reviewed those policies for those 100 cities, and what we found was that there were a set of 8 restrictions that some of those cities had that others did not, that were associated with significantly lower rates of killings by police. And as you said, these are very common sense things, and you would think that they would be in place in your city, but in most cases they are not. So these are things like requiring officers to use every alternative available to them before using deadly force, so making deadly force an actual last resort. And yet only 44 of the 100 largest cities had that policy in place. It includes things like banning chokeholds and strangleholds, as we saw the damage that technique can cause in Minneapolis. And yet only 28 of the 100 largest cities had that in place. Bottom line is when we conducted a statistical analysis evaluating what happens when departments go from 0 to all 8 of those policies, controlling for a variety of factors, including arrest rates and crime rates and rates of assaults on officers and demographics of the community and the size of the police force, controlling for all of these factors, what we found was that going from 0 to 8 of these policies is associated with a 72% reduction in killings by police. So bottom line, these policies matter. They can save lives. And yet, as I said, the majority of police departments don't have these policies in place. In fact, there are only 2 police departments of the 100 largest cities, San Francisco and Tucson, Arizona, that have all 8. So that's the campaign. There's really 40 years of research behind the notion that more restrictive use of force policies reduce police violence. And what's fascinating about it is when we look at the data, they actually keep officers safer, too, because officers are less likely to engage in force incidents. Force incidents have a high likelihood of injury for an officer as well. So this is a win-win, and there's no reason it can't be adopted all across the country.
You can read about all of this at 8, the number 8, can'twait.org. Our guest, R. DeRay McKesson, as well as Samuel Singamwe, and Sam, as we're going to call him. And when he comes in, it's perfect. You can find out. Ban chokeholds, strangleholds, require de-escalation, require warning before shooting, exhaust all other means before shooting, duty to intervene, ban shooting at moving vehicles, require use of force continuum, require comprehensive reporting. Don, you and I have talked at length with lots and lots of folks, and DeRay and Sam, you know, this is a union issue, right? This is an FOP issue in most places that get between this and officers who on their own would say, these are probably good ideas. This is probably going to, you know, make me not traumatized in the end. These are things that are designed for the community, for citizens, for everyone, but certainly here in Baltimore, and DeRay, you can speak to this, and Don, you can as well, that the police union is usually the thing in the middle of this that needs to be negotiated with it. That has been very, very hard to do in modern America, correct?
Well, that's the cool thing about these policies, right? Is that these policies are the purview of the mayor in almost every city in America. They don't require negotiation. They don't require legislation. But you actually can just implement them. And that's the cool thing about this. So we think about this as a first step, that there are a lot more steps to get to the end of police violence, and the end of centering the police as the recipe for public safety. But this is the first step, and mayors could do this today. All across the country, mayors could ban chokeholds. Only 28 of the 100 largest cities ban chokeholds today. That's ridiculous, right? Like, we could do this quickly if leaders had political courage.
Dr. Ray, do you and Sam and others, do you have, I mean, you're obviously well-connected. You have a huge network. Will you be presenting the ideas in 8 Can't Wait to Senator Booker and to Senator Harris for their consideration for inclusion in whatever police reform legislation they come up with on a federal level?
Sam?
Yeah, so, you know, we've already provided feedback to that legislation in order to insert many of the types of things that we've been talking about. We're in active conversation with both of them, as well as other folks in Congress, really highlighting the need for these types of policies to be in place. But again, it's important to recognize that the federal government is relatively limited in its ability to enforce these standards across the country, because currently they're only able to change them in the departments either that they can investigate through the Department of Justice. But right now, they only have the resources of the Department of Justice to investigate 3 departments a year, and that was under the Obama administration. Currently, it's 0 departments a year under this administration. And then they also have power to change policies using federal funding and conditioning it on the adoption of these policies. But again, they don't fund a whole lot of police departments, and it's not a big part of their budget. So this has to be a local strategy first, a state strategy second, to scale those policy changes and translate them into state law. And then the federal government needs to come in particular jurisdictions that refuse to adopt them and hold them accountable through pattern and practice investigations. So every level of government has a role to play, but it's important to stress that mayors can take action to adopt these things right now. We don't have to wait on the federal government.
Well, and the nice thing is for folks listening right now who are wondering how you find, want to know how your particular community stacks up, the 8 Can't Wait website, very interactive. You just go right on the homepage, go down the bottom, you type in the name of your city or county, and it'll show you immediately whether or not your subdivision is embracing these concepts or not. DeRay, while we have you both, I mean, you've been an activist. You've been out there in the streets. You mentioned you've been tear gassed. What was your reaction the other night when Americans watched in horror as peaceful protesters outside of the White House had military turn on them and begin to shoot rubber bullets and tear gas in a crowd so a president could make his way to a church and hold a Bible upside down for a photo op? What was your reaction as an American and as a community activist?
You know, I was shocked, like I think the rest of the world was. It also reminded me of everything we've been saying that was true, right? We told people that the police often inflicted pain on community members and when they weren't doing anything, but people didn't believe us. And in that moment, it was a moment where people saw the police just harm people who weren't armed with anything but cell phones and the truth. And they did it in the name of an order from Donald Trump. And it was like, just a glaring thing. You know, I'm happy that the Arlington Police Department said that they will not, they're reconsidering their relationship to support at the White House now because of how egregious that was to use police resources to do that. It also shows the fragile ego of the president. I was disappointed that the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff was there. I was disappointed that Attorney General Barr was there. That this is like the seeds for a dictatorship. So as much as people complain about the property damage of the protesters, people need to really be worried about just the heinous way that Trump is using his power.
Well, you know, how difficult is it, DeRay? And again, you've been an organizer of large protests, and we've seen over the past week to 10 days, you know, hundreds and thousands and thousands and thousands of peaceful protesters, and then something happens and it turns violent, whether that's through outside activity. It will be difficult to sort that out. But as someone who's tried to organize these protests, how difficult is it to maintain control, to make sure that they don't turn violent where you lose sight of your message or control of your message?
Yeah, you know, people learn and grow in how to move crowds of people you don't know. You know, we were in the street for 400 days, so we had a whole lot of time to practice and make mistakes. You know, this is like day 11 or 12 of the protest. So there are so many new people outside, sort of learning and honing those skills. So I have faith that people, I know people are getting it, and they, you know, you learn and you grow, so that's cool. Baltimore is a great example of young people leading. You know, you think about who's in the street in Baltimore, it's younger people sort of leading huge crowds of people through the street. So I have a lot of faith in people, you know, and I know that people will always try to exploit the righteous anger of others and their community members stepping up, not letting those people take advantage of what's happening right now, because this is the moment that people are upset. And also a moment that people are demanding real change.
DeRay, you tried to make real change 4 years ago. You ran for mayor, and we're now at the point, and we may have a result at some point, pal, but certainly Don has expended a lot of his youthful energy in furious anger in regard to elections and where we are and not having results and what happened over in the first district and Zeke Cohen's district and in that election. Some thoughts about your morning after, and had you been the candidate or you've been Brandon or thinking you might win, you could win, and we're not even sure that the system's not screwed up, right?
Yeah, you know Baltimore. It's like all the promise, and we've just never had great leadership in such a long time, which is the sad part about City Hall, is that Baltimore is such a beautiful city, right? It's like
it's incredible.
All the ingredients, of something special, with failed leadership at the city level, like time after time after time. So I'm hopeful. We'll see what happens in this election. We'll see how it comes out. And this mayor has like a real challenge in the hand, because you know, right, is that there are a lot of partners in the city, and the nonprofit space has sort of held the city together for so long. But if we had a strong mayor with a real vision and a real plan, we could just do so much, you know, and we just haven't had that in a long time.
What's a strong plan right now? Give me what you know now that you didn't know 4 years ago. If you and I went out and put a plan together, wrote one up and ran and got a million votes and ran the city, what's the right plan for Baltimore in 2020?
Well, I think the experts knew this. I don't, you know, city leadership has just been a challenge, but we know that the safest neighborhoods are not the neighborhoods with the more police, they're the neighborhoods with more resources. So, you know, it's no shock in Baltimore that the neighborhoods with more arrests, with more crime, are the poorest neighborhoods. So we know that, like, the solution has always been, how do we think about redistributing resources? How do we think about giving people the things they need so they can make different choices? How do we think about strengthening the school system so people graduate with skills to go do a range of things? Not rocket science, but again, we just haven't had a mayor who can, like, convene all the parties, bring everybody on the same page, align resources. Like, we just haven't had that before.
DeRay, what did you learn? You know, Nestor occasionally talks about and ponders that, you know, maybe he'll run. You know, maybe he'll put his effort where his mouth is and say, look, I keep talking about making the city better.
I've been collecting people for 30 years on the radio. What am I going to do with them, you know? How do you activate?
Maybe I will run. You did that. What did you learn when you ran for mayor, both the good and the bad, or I guess they say the good, the bad, the ugly. What'd you learn by that effort when you threw your heart and soul into that?
Yeah, you know, I learned the good is that I learned that people care about the city and people have a vision and people see the future. I think the struggle was, you know, people aren't always used to hearing solutions. So we would be on the stage at a forum and people were like, what are you going to do about education? And like a leading candidate would literally be like, I'm going to fix education. And people would clap. You're like, that was not an answer, right? Like, that was not an answer. So it was really weird to watch people run solely on personality with literally no plan, no idea, not an understanding of like what you do in office. Like, that was really wild to watch.
Duray McKesson joining us here, as well as Sam Singamwe. They might pronounce that right for me, Sam, so I know you're still out there. So I get it right?
It's Sinyangwe.
Sinyangwe. Thank you very much. I wasn't that far off. That's pretty good. For you guys in doing this in Baltimore and in D.C. and all these places, I guess the internet has been so connected for everyone. Other than just coming to your site and reading and understanding policy, to your point, DeRay, one of the toughest things to do is get anybody to read past the first blurb or the headline to get down into the weeds of how to fix things. What is your wish for our audience here as we watch this unfold yet again, that we come out of this in some better way at the end of the year? And obviously, voting the orange TV con man out of office is first and foremost, and that should be first and foremost for anybody. But moving forward, your wish for what your movement and the spirit of your movement is going to birth at some point here.
Sam?
We lost Sam again.
Yeah, so I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
Oh, there you go.
Couple of things. You know, I think in the first step, most immediately, things that could be done in the next few days. It's clear that cities and hopefully states too can take the lead in raising the standards on use of force across the country. We know that this can save lives right now. Implementing those 8 policies and 8 can't wait. That again, as DeRay said, mayors can take action right away. States can introduce legislation requiring this for all departments within the state. So that needs to happen right away. The second thing is we need to start shrinking the role of the police. We know that there are cities that are thinking about doing this, that there are cities that have started to do this, and that those initiatives have been successful. So you look at places like Eugene, Oregon, where they decided they were not going to send police officers to calls involving people going through mental health crisis anymore. They recognize that many of those interactions ended up escalating to force, including deadly force. And so they just decided to send unarmed mental health responders instead. That has been a successful approach. Now, 1 in every 5 911 calls, they have a mental health responder instead of a police officer arriving at the scene. We want to scale up those approaches. We want to better understand them. How do you build them out? What's the infrastructure that's required? How do we support state legislation like has been proposed in California with the Crises Act in order to fund and resource those alternative approaches to issues that police are currently responding to in many cases unsuccessfully. So that's sort of the medium-term approach. Also, we want to address issues with accountability. We know that only 7% of all excessive force complaints nationwide result in any type of accountability for the officers. And we want to change that. That means addressing the issues involving police unions and the ways in which they structure their contracts with cities that make it much harder to investigate and discipline officers and then allow officers, if they've been fired, to get their jobs back in a large number of cases. So we want to address that as well. And I think long term, it's about envisioning what would it look like if we had a system, systems and structures that did good rather than caused harm. How do we resource systems and structures to do good rather than invest in systems and structures that do harm? So that's big picture. That'll take local, state, and federal action. But I think we're on the path to changing minds, changing the conversation. And I think that's the first step to changing policy and law.
DeRay, for you, Interim Chief of Human Capital, that's an interesting title. We had fire chiefs and police chiefs last week. Tell me about human capital and people in the streets. And certainly here in Baltimore, one of the things we've talked so much about is the squeegee boy situation, saying, is that a job? Is that a need? I've had county people saying, I don't come to the city. I'll never come to the city. All of that. But human capital and people and maximizing potential for every citizen in every way. Speak to that for Baltimore City Public Schools, and what your dream is 5, 10 years from now, when I see these young children, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, where they're going to be 10 years from now in the big picture of human capital in Baltimore.
Yeah, so you know, like I know that the school system is underfunded, and it's not fair, it's criminal, and I don't know what people think the school system can do when the city and state just refuse to fund it adequately. But at the Chief Human Capital, I managed everything to do with adults. So hiring, firing, the labor unions, health insurance, professional development, recruitment, everything to deal with adults. And it was really important to make sure that adults had what they need so that they could walk into classrooms and be excellent every day. They could walk into schools and be excellent every day. They shouldn't have to wait 3 hours to get somebody on the phone if they have a question about their benefits, or they shouldn't have to worry about their certification. We should just process it correctly the first time. So that's what my job was there, was to make sure that the employee experience was smooth and to make sure that employees got what they needed so that they could have everything ready for kids, you know? And when I think about kids, you know, like I know that the school system has struggled historically. The system is built for 100,000 kids. We even had over 80,000 kids in a long time. So kids are moving. The city population is decreasing. And this is what happens when you don't have leadership at the city level. The current superintendent is incredible, Dr. St. Felicis. I'd work with her any day, anywhere, in any position. She is she's great. So I originally came back. That's why I was interim. I came back originally for a month. I was going to help them open up school. And then we got news that we might have to lay off 1,000 people. So I stayed through the first year to just help manage the ship and then turn it over to somebody new so I can go back to the work of ending police violence.
You talk about recruiting teachers. Don and I have talked about that at length, and recruiting teachers into the city so that we can have them, retain them. Recruiting, maybe that's okay. Retaining is probably the harder part. Speak to that a little bit and how important that is for children in our city and for the strength of the city. We need our teachers to be our leaders here.
Yeah, so, you know, urban school systems lose about 10% of teachers every year, and that was true of Baltimore. We lost about 10% of teachers a year. The reality is that in education, people normally stay because of leadership. They either move or leave because of leadership. Either the principal or like assistant principal, whoever is managing their part of the school, is great and they'll stay, or it's not great and they got to go. So that's what we found time and time again.
Don knows all about that, right?
Amen.
DeRay, we appreciate you coming on today. Sam, I appreciate you guys. We're going to send everybody out to Campaign Zero as well as 8can'twait.org to learn about policies in cities all over the country. You can take action right now. I tip my cap to you guys and all that you've been through and all that you're fighting for every citizen, for people that you're never going to meet, people you haven't met. But I know you've picked up a lot of people along the way and fighting for the right cause. And we really do appreciate you guys.
Hey, Nestor, before you take us out of here, I do have one quick question for DeRay. DeRay, we had Ben Jealous on earlier, and he talked about you need to go to the rooftop and look to the arc of history. You've now been involved in this for quite a while, but you're still a young guy. Go to that rooftop and look out 15 or 20 years from now and tell me what you see on the streets of America.
Yeah, I think that we'll have a conception of safety that is not rooted in the police, that is something way beyond the police. People have resources. You know, COVID, before COVID, people said there weren't resources. We couldn't do it. When COVID happened, we figured out how to feed every kid in the city breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We figured out how there could be enough money. You know, there was no money for health care, and then $3 trillion comes, right? I think that people will be much more imaginative in the future and sort of make the government show up for them, because that's what government is. Government exists to redistribute goods and services to meet the public good. And I think that we have to make government follow up on that. So I have a lot of hope. Every day I'm in the street, I have even more hope because I see a generation of people who are fed up and willing to fight for it. And that, to me, is a true sign of progress.
Well, you guys, nobody's been better at mobilizing all that. Sam, really appreciate you. Sam Sinyamwe, as well as DeRay McKesson, Campaign Zero, 8 Can't Wait. You can find them. Google those guys. They're out on Twitter. They're out on Instagram. They're everywhere that you can stand up for what's right. We appreciate you, fellas. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you so much.
You got it. Samson Yamwe and DeRay McKesson, 8cantwait.org, a project by Campaign Zero. There's so much information out of Campaign Zero, taking deliberate action by policymakers at every level of government to end police violence. You could take a pledge and sign an agenda to end police violence up on their website. Joincampaignzero.org. Joincampaignzero.org. I am Nestor on behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller. We are eating Taharka ice cream. I'm waiting on some shrimp and grits over at our friends at State Fair in Catonsville, and always ordering those crab cakes from Fadley's, shipping them everywhere in the world, picking them up curbside as well. I need some mac and cheese from Fadley's. And don't forget Moeller and Gary Realty as well. I owe Jeff Moeller a segment later on at WNST. We're going to talk about baseball coming back or not coming back and life after COVID. He's selling homes at Moeller and Gary Realty. You can find him at MoellerandGary.com. You can find former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller and I anywhere Baltimore Positive travels, out on Facebook and Twitter and throughout the interweb. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Keeping calm, staying local, and always Baltimore Positive.